Newsreel Digest is on the air. Newsreel Digest presenting headlines of the day's news and on-the-spot highlights recorded the world over by the people who make the news. Transcribed from last week's Mutual Newsreel. Yes, Newsreel Digest is on the air. First, today's headline news. Some 370,000 soft coal miners refused to work today without a contract. And President Truman, acting under the Taft-Hartley law, appointed three men to investigate the dispute and give him their opinions within 1 week. They start their task tonight. But already the miners are saying, it looks like a showdown. No break is in sight in the cross-country telephone strike scheduled by the CIO for Wednesday morning. Federal mediators in New York are trying to get a postponement agreement this afternoon. J. Edgar Hoover told a congressional committee today that the FBI and British intelligence are on the trail of further ramifications growing out of the arrest of a British scientist accused of giving atomic secrets to Russia. During a Senate hearing today, Republican Representative Robert Hale said the country isn't frightened enough by atomic weapons. But Senator Elbert Thomas said people are too jittery. He wishes they were more complacent. In a Polish court in Stettin today, a French consular employee pleaded guilty with a smile to being a spy. He told the judge, I like the job. Washington hears that France will be given five American baby destroyers as part of her armament deliveries under the Atlantic Pact. In Stuttgart, U.S. High Commissioner McCloy has warned Western Germans to stop attacking the Western Allies, to remember their guilt for the war. He has reminded them, we Americans are not here exclusively to feed the German people. West Germany is backing out of an agreement with East Germany, say American officials in Frankfurt. The West Germans have decided to stop sending steel to the communist-controlled East. There was a fire today at a big oil refinery in East Chicago, Indiana. A company spokesman announced that the fire was under control and that nobody was injured. In Los Angeles, a rival mob tried again during the night, this was the sixth time, to kill California's gambling czar, Mickey Cohen. They got past the dogs and they got past the radar to bomb and tear apart Cohen's $100,000 house. But they didn't get Mickey. So much for today's top developments. Now for the highlights from last week's Mutual Newsreel, which Mondays through Fridays brings you on-the-spot developments by the people who make the news. From where it happens, you hear it happen. Newsreel Highlight, Monday, January 30th, 1950.
Congress gets the president's tax message. Reception isn't noticeably warm. In brief, Mr. Truman calls for reduction of 7 excise taxes, provided the revenue loss is offset by plugging loopholes in other tax laws. He wants to revise corporation, estate, and gift levies to bring in an extra $1 billion. Here's the reaction of New York Congressman Leonard Hall, who is chairman of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee.
The president's tax message is an insult to Congress. He tells the representatives and the senators that if they do not pass an excise reduction bill that meets his approval, he will promptly veto it. In addition to insulting the members of Congress, the president has set himself up as a dictator and is attempting to crack the whip as no other president has done in our history. I hope that all members of Congress accept the president's challenge and write a tax bill for all of the people of the nation and not just to meet the dictates of one man in the White House.
No comment from the chairman of the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee other than a promise that the president's program is going to get full consideration. In the meantime, salesgirls and shoppers are keeping their fingers crossed. For years, they've struggled with that 20% tax on certain items. Now there's a chance of its being repealed. Our reporter hikes over to Macy's department store in New York to get some reaction. A salesgirl in the handbag department looks at a jewelry counter and points out,
luxury. I mean, you really don't. You could go to 5 and 10 and buy it for 25 cents instead of say 10 and $5, I think. I really do. I mean, a handbag is much different. It's just like a man's wallet. Men have 8 pockets. We don't.
Even the customers in the jewelry department agreed with that. And in that department, 2 shoppers get involved over whether we should or should not have a tax on jewelry and furs.
But I think it's too high. There may might be a tax, but I really think that 20% is really very high.
Don't run away.
Well, I think a woman that could afford a fur coat could positively afford a higher taxes. But I feel very sorry for the people that have to work and live in furnished rooms and just make a small salary, like I just paid $1.20 tax for a little bag that I needed a necessity.
I wish I'd made in consideration. Oh. But even with the furs, I don't mean the minks and things like that, yes. But I mean there are people who buy the cheaper furs. But then 20% really brings it up too high.
Thank you all. I won't block the
aisle. Our reporter just got out of that one in time. And for all we know, it's still going on.
Newsreel Highlight, Tuesday, January 31st, 1950.
Punxsutawney, spelled P-U-N-X-S-A-T-A-W-N-E-Y. Punxsutawney is a town in northwestern Pennsylvania. About 9,000 people live there. Some Hollywood movie producers put out a film about a Punxsutawney, and they put their Punxsutawney in West Virginia, which doesn't even have a Punxsutawney. This brings up a situation which has Pennsylvania Congressman Leon Gavin pretty mad.
Now everyone knows that there is no such place as Punxsutawney, West Virginia. And I understand that West Virginia is working up a lot of ballyhoo trying to change the name of some village down there so that they might have legitimate claim to the film's first appearance.
Pardon me, Congressman, but is it legal for any state to regard that it has the entire...
I want to register objection to West Virginia's effort to grab the fair name and fame of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. The only Punxsutawney that is in existence anywhere is Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, a town well known to every American. Punxsutawney is the home of that great prognosticator of the weather, the groundhog.
Excuse me, Congressman, but it sounded like you said groundhog. Now, does the groundhog live...
You will hear from him on February 2nd, Groundhog Day. I am presenting here with a letter received from the Punxsutawney Chamber of Commerce, directed to the Copyright Office of the Library of Congress, requesting necessary forms and applications for copyrighting the name of Punxsutawney to protect the name against the infringement of those who would like to reflect in the glories of that great groundhog city, Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
Punxsutawneyans are peaceful, law-abiding citizens. But one more hostile move like that on the part of West Virginia, and they're likely to break off diplomatic relations.
Now a moment for an important message for all Americans. What do you want most in life? Maybe it's a good job, good health, a home, and a family. But above all, you want security. Yes, everyone wants security, and the wise man will make his future secure by preparing for it, by saving automatically, systematically, week after week, by buying United States savings bonds. In just 10 years, you get back $4 for every $3 you put in. That's a substantial dividend from a safe, guaranteed investment. It's a perfect way to give that youngster of yours a college education or assure yourself of a comfortable retirement without financial worry. So join the payroll savings plan where you work or use the systematic bond a month plan at your bank. And when you can, buy an extra bond at any bank or post office and make your future extra secure. Remember, today is yesterday's tomorrow. Make your tomorrow secure today. Buy United States savings bonds now. Newsreel Highlight, Wednesday, February 1st, 1950.
Alger Hiss gets 5 years. Today in New York, the former State Department official, convicted on 2 counts of perjury, is sentenced by Judge Henry Goddard. And here's Newsreel's reporter on the scene as he waited at the Foley Square Federal Courthouse.
Hiss, we're told, is not talking to anybody today, and there are a dozen rumors here now that he has sneaked out through one of the other exits, either through a basement exit and caught a subway or through one of the side doors of this big granite building here, the scene of the communist trial, the scene now of the Judith Copeland trial, and the scene today of Alger Hiss's sentencing to 5 years in prison on each of the counts to run concurrently. In other words, a term of 5 years. We understand that he has secured a $10,000 bond, which will mean freedom for him pending an appeal of the case.
Inside that Foley Square Federal Courthouse, a lady spectator who's been on hand for both his trials, Mrs. Malcolm Logan, of New Orleans and New York had a front row view as Hiss heard his sentence.
Yes, I saw Mr. Hiss. He was very pale, tense, and taut, and as the judge pronounced sentence, he raised his chin just a little higher as if to say, I can take it.
But Hiss's attorney, Claude Cross, already plans an appeal of that sentence. Mrs. Logan says Cross was quick to speak up.
He made a statement in court that he was going to appeal the case and suggested that he was he, as a good American, still believed in Hiss and that all the facts in the case had not come out, even though there's been two trials on this.
Still another chance for Alger Hiss. But today, after his second trial, guilty of perjury and ordered to prison for 5 years.
Newsreel Highlight, Thursday, February 2nd, 1950.
Henry Wallace denies sending Adam's secrets to Russia. The former vice president appears at his own request before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Among other things, he denies that his Board of Economic Warfare okayed uranium export licenses. He says the board had no such power. And committee counsel Frank Tanever demands...
You make that statement in spite of the fact that the executive order says that it should be cleared, that arrangements should be made for the clearance of it through BEW, and that was merely a pro forma arrangement.
I do make that definitely, flatly, completely, and indignantly.
Once again, Wallace loses his studied calm. So much so that committee chairman John Wood of Georgia gets in the fracas.
As the wartime vice president of the United States, I feel very deeply on this subject, and I think that I did a good job, and this kind of questioning, I think, is not helpful.
The response that's just been made to the question, Mr. Wallace, is an improper response. And I'm going to have it stricken from the record in a reflection that you undertake to make upon the policy of this committee. It will be stricken from the record.
It is, of course, a great honor to be Vice President of the United States at any time, Mr. Wallace.
Yes, and I don't like to see the Roosevelt administration impugned.
Impugning the Roosevelt administration, says Wallace, adding he never shipped or wanted to share our uranium with Russia.
Newsreel Highlight, Friday, February 3rd, 1950.
The gals shriek, the mayor acts, and street cleaners grumble. Down in Jacksonville, Florida, a mysterious chemical has been playing havoc with the ladies' nylons. Sympathetic Mayor Hayden Burns has ordered his not-so-sympathetic street cleaners to scrub the streets like mad. Joy Coleman of the Jacksonville Journal calls it effort well spent.
My hose budget has really blown the lid. I've had a new run, a pair of hose every day for weeks. I was mentally blaming the store I patronized for keeping old stock when the calls started coming into the journal from other women wondering what was happening to their underpants. I'm not one of the worst sufferers, though. I have only been suffering from immodesty of the knees. Think of the woman whose nylon blouse disintegrated on her right downtown.
Stenographer Jocelyn Brown tells some of the embarrassing things that can happen when the nylon blight strikes.
Now, just imagine yourself walking down the street, and suddenly you feel little holes popping in your stockings. And while you walk calmly along, you feel runs like something was jerking the threads in your hose all over your legs. After 2 minutes, you look more like you'd worn them for a year nonstop and fallen down 3 flights of steps. Right then, in less than 5 minutes, at least $1.65 shot, and you look like something left over from Tobacco Road.
The gallant mayor just couldn't bear to see that happen to these Florida beauties. As for Jacksonville street cleaners, oh, my aching back.
If Mutual Don Lee's Teletest Show calls you on the phone and asks you to name the greatest hour in radio, you just speak up and say, Don Lee's 5-star feature. Teletest is heard every weekday evening at 6:30 over these same stations, and it's the show that tries to find an answer to a jackpot question. So who knows but what you might be called and asked to name the greatest hour in radio. Just remember the answer, 5-star feature. Let me tell you why. Five-star feature is heard every weekday evening from 6 to 7 o'clock on Mutual Don Lee. At 6 o'clock, you hear the most colorful of all news commentators, Gabriel Heater. At 6:15, Mutual Newsreel demonstrates the magic of radio as it takes you all over the world to where the news actually happens. Then there's Telotest at 6:30, followed by that metal wizard, The Answer Man, at 6:45. Bill Henry in the news at 6:55 completes this great hour. Remember, five-star feature every weekday night on Mutual Don Lee from 6 to 7 o'clock. You've been listening to Newsreel Digest, presenting headlines of the day's news and on-the-spot highlights recorded the world over by the people who make the news, transcribed from last week's Mutual Newsreel. Listen to Mutual Newsreel over the station each evening, Monday through Friday, at 6:15. Then, for the highlights of the week from where it happens, you hear it happen, listen to Newsreel Digest. This is the Mutual Don Lee Broadcasting System.